Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello, I'm Mark Riley.
And I'm Rob Hughes.
And you're listening to the A to Z of David Bowie,
the greatest rock and roll star in the world, ever, ever.
N is for Never Let Me Down.
Never Let Me Down, David Bowie's 17th studio album. And it has to be said, Mark, probably his most maligned.
Yes.
All right. Released on the 20th of April, 1987 on EMI America. He conceived the album as a basis for all the theatrics of the Glass Spider tour, writing and recording most of the songs in Switzerland. He said at the time he wanted to get back to rock and roll.
It is ironic, isn't it? I mean, his view on the album and what he wanted it to be and what it turned out to be. All that will unfold, won't it?
It will.
So Never Let Me Down was certified gold in early July 1987, less than 3 months after its release, and charted in the top 10 in several European countries, although it only reached number 34 in the US. Despite its commercial success, the album was poorly received by fans and critics. Bowie later distanced himself from the arrangement and production of the finished album, but also admitted a fondness for many of the songs, which we will get into later.
We will. In fact, so in July 2018, it was announced that the album would be re-released as Never Let Me Down 2018. Which is all part of this, the Bowie Loving the Alien box set, isn't it? With a brand new production and new instrumentation overseen by a producer and engineer, Mario J. McNulty.
Okay, and we will mention at this point in time, many of you out there, you'd be Bowie nuts like us, you might well have seen Bob's brilliant piece in Uncut, and we'll get to some of the actual outtakes and all that kind of stuff a little bit later on, but that is the sound of me dangling a carrot. Ooh. Before we look at the development of the album, I mean, I'd kind of not really taken much interest in this album.
Yeah, same here. I mean, when it came out, I wasn't even interested, I'll be honest, in Bowie full stop that year, which is terrible because I wish I'd seen the Glass Spider tour, as I said. But I mean, you know, recording wise, I just wasn't kind of going for it at that point in time.
I mean, I loved Let's Dance, and we saw Milton Keynes, didn't we?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, straight off the back of that, the next run, as we know, has been well documented. It wasn't our favourite period of his career, nor his favourite period of his career.
Yes.
And the irony is that, of course, the album is called Never Let Me Down. But the actual sentiment behind the song is completely heartfelt. And again, we'll delve into all that.
Sure.
So the development of the album, following the mainstream success of Let's Dance and its subsequent Serious Moonlight tour, Bowie felt disconnected from his new fan base after the poor reception of Tonight from 1984, and he was looking to make the next album differently. It's strange, isn't it? Because it's careful what you wish for. And we've talked about it before, but when 1983 came around and he'd just actually gotten out of the ties, a handcuff with Tony DeFries, and so he was hell-bent on making money, and he did it in a brilliant fashion with Let's Dance. But then, of course, it created this monster because, as we know, Bowie was a very intellectual and very mischievous and adventurous guy, and he felt backed up into a bit of a hole, didn't he?
Well, of course, you know, as successful as he'd been up until that point, he was still seen as, you know, the great outsider of rock music, wasn't he? You could sort of always count on Bowie for being on the fringes and a bit difficult and edgy. Suddenly he's right there in the mainstream, attracting the same kind of audience as Phil Collins and the Stones and all the kind of really big hitters of the 80s, and he didn't know what to do with himself.
Yeah, and you know, and doing duets with Tina Turner, who is amazing, but obviously she defined mainstream, really, didn't she, around about that time. Anyway, so Bowie said he wanted to return to recording with a small rock group like he had early in his career, and that he made the album as a move back to rock and roll music very directly. And Bowie felt that the sound of his new album was closer to that of Scary Monsters and Super Creeps than its immediate predecessors.
Right, he does have a point there. As mentioned before, he spent the middle of 1986 at home in Switzerland writing songs, then recorded a few demos with Erdal Kizilkay before working on the album with the full band. So for the first time since Scary Monsters, Bowie played instruments on the record in addition to singing, because people forget, don't they, that Let's Dance had a few covers on it and he redid stuff like Cat People. Tonight had some covers, including that terrible Beach Boys one. So for the first time in a while, he seemed sort of re-energised, didn't he? He wanted to get involved, more engaged with the recording he was making. However it turned out, at least the process was a healthy one.
It was kind of a healing process after tonight, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, again, yeah, I think he just stopped in his tracks and looked back at what he'd just been doing and felt that he needed to readjust himself and getting back online, as you say, being known as a changeling
yeah.
and not being at all predictable.
Yeah. So on some tracks on the album, Bowie plays keyboards, synthesizer, rhythm guitar on a couple as well, 87 and Cry and New York's in Love. He plays lead guitar.
Yeah, which he wasn't really that well known for, was he? Let's be honest. So the album took 3 months to write and record. Bowie later acknowledged that the songs on the album lacked a cohesive musical style, which he claimed reflected his eclectic music tastes at the time, and stated that the album was a reflection of all the styles of writing I've used over the last few years.
Didn't sell it well there.
No, not really.
So one of the people that he recruited to play in it is his old mate Peter Frampton on lead guitar, which Frampton was really so thrilled about, because he didn't expect it from the start. Of course, they go right back, don't they, to Bromley. So this was Peter Frampton talking to me not long ago for the Uncut thing. I love this. He said, I think Dave. So he called him Dave. You know, they were that close.
We've talked about this, haven't we? Because I put on Twitter not that long ago my David Bowie membership card from 1973, expires 1974. And in the year 2000, David Bowie, via Blam, thank you, Blam,
yeah.
he signed it to me for Mark. Dave Bowie, because we used to call him Dave Bowie from the Dave Bowie band.
Yeah.
And I know that he didn't like being called Dave, particularly at that point in his career.
Yeah.
I don't think even from like the 70s onwards, he never really signed anything Dave, did he?
No, he didn't.
But growing up with Peter Frampton, it would have been Dave, wouldn't
he? Of course, it's Dave and Pete.
I'm sure he was the same for Jeff McCormack and George
yeah.
Underwood. He probably was Dave, wasn't he?
But, absolutely.
Yeah, the actual the autograph with Dave on it is pretty collectible.
I've seen that. It's great. So, so Frampton says, yeah, I think Dave was very protective of me. I guess this is because it was almost a family connection with my dad, Owen, of course, as well. He was always there. I just had to reach out. I got out of the teeny bopper thing with the Herd because of Humble Pie. I became a guitar player again, thank God. Then, of course, Frampton Comes Alive came out and I got turned back into this pop thing because of the way I looked, and the guitar got kind of forgotten, even though I'm playing guitar all the time on the record.
Yeah, he continued, Davey definitely felt bad for me because of the bad rap I got as a pin-up and the face again, in inverted commas. That's why I believe he called me to do Never Let Me Down, knowing full well that he wanted me to play on the Glass Spider tour, and that doing both, especially the tour, going around the world, once in stadiums and once in arenas, he was reintroducing me as a musician, as a guitar player, and for that I can never thank him enough. And you did interview Peter Frampton, didn't you?
Yeah.
We will get to that, but also I just gave you the heads up about the footage of him wandering around. Is it Milan?
It's Madrid during the Glass Spider tour. It's brilliant. You mean, obviously, you kind of sent that to me. It's a great link, as a for about 15 minutes or so, but it's so informal, isn't it? Just Bowie and Frampton wandering around looking for a bar, ostensibly, but just gradually attracting this huge audience, as you would do.
Yeah, I mean, it is great, because Bowie said, oh, it's just a normal day in my life, walking through the streets with me mate, being followed by 300 people. But obviously he's got a cameraman with him and he's got a microphone with him, but it starts off with him going and rummaging through a skip.
That's right.
But the great thing is, Bowie's just there, very confident, very happy, and Peter Frampton just chips in every now and then.
He does.
He seems a little bit kind of like in awe of Bowie,
yeah.
doesn't he?
There's also that protective thing coming through in that you were just mentioning there, because as a point where obviously the fans are coming up to Bowie in hordes, aren't they, for autographs and all the rest of it, and a few of them start saying, isn't that Peter Frampton with you? And Bowie's, no, don't worry about him, no, it's not him, and just almost kind of shielding him from this fame.
I mean, he's probably just dreading the point where somebody goes wow, which would inevitably happen.
Of course
it would have done if I was there anyway.
Carlos Alomar, of course, is the band leader on Never Let Me Down, Bowie's trusted ally. He was talking about his relationship with Frampton. Yeah, he said, we bonded as lead guitar player and rhythm player, and also, of course, on the Glass Spider tour as well. That man, talking about Frampton, could play his ass off. He's a sweetheart, and I thought that David taking him and putting him on the pedestal that he so deserved was just amazing. I thought that was equal to what he'd done with Iggy Pop.
It's a very good point, that, yeah. So Bowie wrote the album's lead single, Day In, Day Out, because of his concern about the treatment of homeless people in the US. Some networks banned the song's video, which Bowie found ridiculous.
Yeah, he did. Time Will Crawl, which Bowie named as his favourite track on the album, was inspired by events from the Chernobyl disaster and the idea that somebody from one's own neighbourhood could be responsible for the end of the world. He actually said that vocally, he owed a lot to Neil Young on that track.
Right.
And noted that the variety of voices he used on the album were a nod to the musicians who'd influenced him in the past.
Okay, as Kooks was influenced by Neil Young, evidently, wasn't it? The title track, Never Let Me Down, is about Bowie's longtime personal assistant, Coco Schwab. The song was the last one written for the album, written and recorded in one day during the last week of mixing the album at New York's Power Station Studios. Bowie attributed the vocal performance on this track to John Lennon. So we've covered Coco Schwab, haven't we? But you have to say this, she did save his life, and she did Never Let Him Down. And you know, even now, after David's passing, she's never seemingly let him down, you know?
Not at all.
I mean, the first thing that she could have done would be run off and either do a load of interviews or write a book about David Bowie, albeit with the absolute best intentions and all of the love that she had for him. Not a dicky bird.
Not at all.
Yep. So dignified and brilliant. So Coco Schwab, we salute you.
Absolutely. She's kept her counsel, hasn't she? And you have to remember, she was there for everything. Oh, she was there for everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
The A to Z of David Bowie, with Mark Riley and Rob Hughes.
All right, so the song Zeros, according to Bowie, was a bit of a nostalgia trip. He said, I wanted to put in every 60s cliche I could think of, stopping and preaching and letting love in, all that kind of stuff. I hope there's a humorous undertone to it, but the subtext is definitely that trappings of rock are not what they're made out to be. So this plays into that whole thing we were talking about, doesn't it? You know, he achieved this megastar mainstream fame and he didn't like it.
Yeah.
Reeves Gabrels got to know him on the Glass Spider tour pretty well. And he said recently, he said, the only thing that David said being famous is good for is getting a good table in a restaurant. So you're not near the kitchen, or getting free tickets for shows.
Right, okay. So this is where it takes a really bizarre turn. Actor Mickey Rourke asked Bowie to be involved in one of the songs, the two having met in London where Rourke was based whilst filming A Prayer for the Dying. So this is a little bit forward, isn't it?
Just a bit.
Can I be on one of your songs?
I mean, he could have said no, but he didn't.
No, that is an interesting one, isn't it? So Bowie had him perform the mid-song rap to the song Shining Star, Making My Love. Bowie jokingly referred to Rourke's performance as method rapping, which has got to be a euphemism for crap.
It's terrible.
It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, there are some things about this album that just aren't salvageable, are they? Bowie described the song as one that reflects back to street situations and how people are trying to get together in the face of so many disasters and catastrophes around them, not knowing if they're going to survive it themselves. So the one thing they've got to cling on to is each other, although it might resolve into something terrible.
And so when you're thinking of all of those things in the world going on, you immediately go to Mickey Rourke to do a rap.
Of course you do.
Shining Star was one of Bowie's early choices to be a single for the album. Ooh. But, thankfully, I just dropped that in, EMI had the final say and did not release the song as a single. No surprise there then. So Bowie called New York's In Love a sarcastic song about the vanity of big cities. In the complete David Bowie, Nick Pegg, hello, would call the song a strong contender for the wooden spoon of the album.
One of the other contenders for wooden spoon is Too Dizzy, isn't it?
It was the first song Bowie and new collaborator Kizilke, is that how you pronounce
Kizilke,
it?
Kizilke, I think.
Kizilke wrote together for the album and written in homage to the 50s. Now, I'm going to stop at this point and people might be going, it's not homage, Mark, it's homage. Oh. It's not, it's an English word. And it is homage.
It's homage.
People always expect it to be a French word and put the fancy bit on the end. But yes. It ain't. I just thought I'd drop that in.
Well done.
Bowie at the time called the song a throwaway and seemed surprised that he included it on the album, which is a weird way of looking at it. I'm surprised I put that on the album.
How did that get there?
Absolutely. The song has been deleted from subsequent reissues of Never Let Me Down.
Which is telling in itself, of course, isn't it? You know, he's in charge of that. When asked about his choice of including Iggy's song Bang Bang on the album, which came out, was it on Party, that early 80s?
Right, yeah.
Bowie stated, Iggy's done so many good songs that people never get to hear. I think it's one of his best, Bang Bang, and it hasn't been heard. Now it might be.
And it's some more coffers in the bank for Iggy Pop, bless
definitely.
Him.
Overall, Bowie summed up the album after it was released in 87 as an effort to re-establish what I used to do, which was a guitar-oriented album. I think the next album will be even more so. Of course, we know now this led to Tin Machine, a whole other project.
It did, yeah. So initial sales of the album were strong but dropped off when it started getting mixed reviews. Spin magazine called it an inspired and brilliantly crafted work. It's charged with a positive spirit that makes art soul food, imbued with a contagious energy that gives ideas is a leg to dance on. Very poetic.
Certainly. Rolling Stone called the album an odd, freewheeling pastiche of elements from all the previous Bowies, going on to call it unfocused and possibly the noisiest, sloppiest Bowie album ever. Never Let Me Down is also something of a mess. I think you said that twice, really. Mm. Billboard magazine's 1987 retrospective called Never Let Me Down arguably the year's most underrated release and considered it a critic's choice for the year. So, divided opinion.
Again, we've talked previously, particularly on the Six Music Radio programme, about an amnesty. Normally, it's for people who give bad reviews to great records, but you just have to wonder conversely if somebody wants a retraction on that. I mean, there are people out there who do like the album, and as we know, it's been revisited,
and we'll get to all that.
Yeah. But Bowie did change his mind about the album because he did defend it, didn't he, at some points? Okay.
He did.
He said, I was not concerned about the album's relative poor performance in the charts, saying, I've made about 20 albums during my career, and so far this is my third biggest seller, so I can't be that disappointed. Yet, it is a letdown that it hasn't been as buoyant as it should be. But I don't really feel that negative about it. As far as I'm concerned, it's one of the better albums I've made. And then on a sixpence, he would turn round eventually.
Yeah, absolutely. So looking at his legacy now. So after the album came out, Bowie was excited to get back into the studio as soon as he could, having written more tunes than he needed for the album. And he started referencing Brian Eno in interviews, said he wanted to record more experimental music. However, due to the poor critical reception of the album and the Glass Spider tour, Bowie put all those plans on hold and instead formed Tin Machine, which he used to just rejuvenate himself.
He did. I mean, it was one of those where you could tell, really, he'd been looking at Iggy Pop for a long time, and I think there was a certain part of Bowie that wanted to be very, very much like Iggy.
Definitely.
Like the rocker with a bit of abandon. Yeah. I mean, obviously, he would never go down the lines of dropping his strides and all that kind of stuff, which Iggy was prone to doing.
No, or smearing himself in peanut butter, probably not.
Oh, well, I don't know. not in public, anyway. That's the thing. And so, as far as Bowie was concerned, it was a band. That was the thing about Tin Machine, and obviously we'll do Tin Machine in a whole different episode.
Yeah, sure.
But he was just straining at the leash to be in a rock and roll band still. So, you know, Never Let Me Down, he attempted it, but he didn't really nail it. And so he just thought, right, okay, I'm going to form a band. So, anyway, his view on the album soured as the years passed. Not Tin Machine, but Never Let Me Down. In 1990, during interviews for his Sound and Vision tour, Bowie commented that he felt like he was in a mire whilst making this album and expressed disappointment at having lost good songs by allowing the album's production to give the songs too much of a session man feel.
Mm.
So he's steering away from the songs and more towards the sound of the album.
Yeah.
And the 80s was synonymous with bad sounding records, wasn't it?
It was, of course it was. This is the element that is the basis of why they ended up re-recording it. But yeah, I mean, it was a weird one as well, because Never Let Me Down just had pre-programmed drums on it. So there's no physical drummer in the studio. It couldn't be more 80s, could it? It's such an 80s sounding record.
It is strange. And then again, if you go back to The Idiot, and that's got a drum machine on it, hasn't it? You know, and Bowie wanted to put live drums on that, and Iggy wouldn't let him. So another kind of little conflict going on there.
Yeah, whilst he was working with Tin Machine on their second album, Bowie was musing on his previous few albums, and he said, "You could tell I was terribly unhappy in the late 80s. I was in that netherworld of commercial acceptance. It was an awful trip from 83 to 86, 87. Those 5 years were simply dreadful. Never Let Me Down. I had good songs that I mistreated. I didn't really apply myself. I wasn't quite sure what I was supposed to be doing. I wish there'd been somebody around who could have told me."
He said this before as well, hasn't he? Four videos particularly, like, and there's some of the stuff around Labyrinth. But
that's,
you know,
right, yeah.
When he finds himself too busy or a little bit distracted and he leaves it to other people, and they come back and he's disappointed with it, and there's nothing you can say because you've turned your back on it and dropped the ball in a way.
Yeah, you can only blame yourself, can't you?
But that's the problem with being a perfectionist, isn't it? If you do leave it to somebody else and it don't come back exactly as you want it, it's just the way of the world, isn't it? It's just the way it is. But Bowie in 1993 said, "Now I listen to Never Let Me Down and I wish I had been less indifferent to its production because there were some good songs on it, but I let it go and it became very soft musically, which wasn't the way I would have done it if I'd have been more involved." So there we go. If you look at him considering it to be soft musically and the intention was to make a rock album, there's a massive conflict. So in 1995, Bowie spoke more at length about how he felt his creativity and music had suffered after the success of Let's Dance. He said, "The great public esteem at that time meant absolutely nothing to me. It didn't make me feel good. I felt dissatisfied with everything I was doing, and eventually it started showing in my work. Let's Dance was an excellent album in a certain genre, but the next two albums after that, Tonight and Never Let Me Down, showed that my lack of interest in my own work was really becoming transparent."
And he continued, "My nadir was Never Let Me Down. It was such an awful album. I've gotten to a place now where I'm not very judgmental about myself. I put out what I do, whether it's in visual arts or in music, because I know that everything I do is really heartfelt. Even if it's a failure artistically, it doesn't bother me in the same way that Never Let Me Down bothers me. I really shouldn't have even bothered going into the studio to record it. In fact, when I play it, I wonder if sometimes I did." And it's a weird one. One of the things that Reeves Gabrels was saying, that even when they were just starting off doing, you know, Tin Machine, Bowie was already kind of whittering to him, saying, "I want to re-record this album I've just done."
Oh, really?
So it was as early as that, yeah, he was sort of having doubts about it all. And of course, one of the reasons this album got such a terrible reputation is that Bowie disowned it. Essentially,
it got some good reviews, some bad reviews, and then people stopped buying it quite quickly. It didn't have any shelf life
at all,
did it?
In fact, he played a lot of the tunes on Glass Spider, obviously, as you're doing. But after that, I don't think he played anything else in concert at all, did he, from that album?
Bowie has said previously, and we've mentioned this in a previous episode, that every now and then he would test the patience of his audience, his fans, but they would come back to him. Mm-hmm. He had this undying faith in them because, and us, I suppose, in that way, because you do flit in and out. I did the same thing around about this time. And I even did, as we've just mentioned, went to Milton Keynes, you know, and I went to see him afterwards as well. I went to the Glass Spider Tour and saw him lots and lots in the last 10 years of his career. Mm. But he knew that every now and then he'd stick his neck out artistically, and sometimes it would work and sometimes it wouldn't. And I think we've come to the conclusion that he didn't on this occasion.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So, I mean, the track list starts with Day In, Day Out.
Time Will Crawl.
Beat of Your Drum.
Never Let Me Down.
Zeros.
Glass Spider.
Shining Star.
New York's In Love.
87 and Cry.
Too Dizzy.
And the Iggy cover, Bang Bang.
Which was also written by Ivan Kral, who was in Iggy Pop's band, wasn't he? Ka-ching!
Yeah, okay. So, moving on to the re-recording then. So, Never Let Me Down, 2018.
Well, you're the expert on this, Bobbert, because you've spent hours and hours and hours interviewing people. Some amazing stuff in there. And
there is.
Obviously, the box sets are being thrown out for Bowie's work at the moment.
Yeah.
They're just brilliant. Mm. And like the releasing of Gouster and all that kind of stuff. I mean, and some of the Bowie nuts are very, very critical of things that are being done. Yeah. And if you look at this period of Bowie's career, it's going to be the hardest one to salvage, really, isn't it?
Absolutely.
But there is a story behind it. So what's the story, Bob?
There is. Okay. So the box set you're talking about, of course, is Loving the Alien. And we should mention as well, you know, there's great stuff on there, like a live performance from Serious Moonlight. So, you know, you can lots to get your teeth into. So the new recording was overseen by Mario McNulty as producer and engineer. And you've got Reeves Gabrels on there with guitar and David Torn, Sterling Campbell, Tim Lefevre, as well as string quartet and a guest cameo by Laurie Anderson. So no more Mickey Rourke on the re-recording. Okay. The seeds of this were sown, firstly, in 2008, when Bowie asked Mario McNulty to remix Time Will Crawl for it was an iSelect compilation, wasn't it?
Right.
So it wasn't just a remix thing. He actually got Sterling Campbell in to play drums and put some strings on it and some other stuff. And then Bowie had said to Mariette Mannulty, he said, oh, to redo the rest of that album.
So this is the thing, really. I mean, the whole project has Bowie's blessing, of course. Bowie has sadly passed away, but it's something that he wanted to see and didn't sadly stick around long enough to.
Yeah, so this remix of Time Will Crawl was the template. And so, you know, come the start of the year when the Bowie estate decides, you know, what were his wishes, you know, this sort of 5-year plan and all the rest of it, and he wanted to get this re-recorded. So they just had that to go off. So there were no kind of hard and fast instructions, just let's do it in this style and we should be okay.
Right, all okay. Right. So fast forward to early 2018, McNulty entered Electric Lady Studios in New York with Sterling and Tim Thingy Bob on bass. Well, how do you pronounce it, Bob?
I say Lefebvre.
Well, that's right. Every time I come back to Tim, you can say his surname. It was in the Black Star Band, an amazing musician, and Reeves Cabrel and David Torner, again, as we say, on guitars. All the musicians had a history with Bowie, so they were just a perfect fit for what would sound like brand new songs. That's what they were hoping, to just breathe some life into them, weren't they?
So I was talking to Mario McNulty about, you know, just how he would approach this, all right? Obviously, with Bowie not around. He said, David made it very clear that he wasn't pleased with Never Let Me Down. He was disappointed with the sound of the album, not just the production, but the sound of it as well, the way it was mixed, where it has this very stereotypical 80s reverb and these programmed drums that don't really match. And also the use of all the keyboards at the time that wasn't to his taste. And to me, it wasn't a surprise that he didn't like it, because when I first heard the album, I felt the same.
It's funny because that is it. I mean, Bowie, as we know, would lead the way. I mean, Ziggy, the sound of Ziggy wasn't anything new, was it?
No.
It was just the great concept and the great songs. But then you hit the mid-70s and he's always pushing ahead, taking stuff, being the magpie and all of those kind of cliches. Yeah. But here he just completely embraced the worst elements of the 80s. Mm. It dated almost immediately,
also,
didn't it?
Also, the thing about you talking about the 70s, there are all those great sonic recordings, you know, and how ahead of the time they were. Suddenly the world had caught up with him and he was no longer kind of a trailblazer, was he, by this point?
That's right. Okay, so this is what Reeves Cabrel said to you, Bobbert. I met David when he was on the Glass Spider tour, and a lot of those songs were being played live at the time. At that point, he already had some reservation about the sound of the record. All the musicians involved on that record played great, but it was more about the sound and the production.
He says, I remember we were sitting on deck chairs by Mountain Studio, looking at the mountains across Lake Geneva. How nice. Mm. And he started telling me, you know, I'm proud of the songs on that album, but I wasn't in the best shape, and I wasn't as present as I should have been at the sessions. And he later pointed to a couch in the studio and said, I did most of my work on there, passed out.
Oh dear. So he blamed himself for a lot of it at that point in time. He suggested that we could try re-recording some of these songs.
So the only reason they didn't was because they were already writing for Tin Machine, and Cabrel thought, let's just push ahead with the new stuff. That makes sense.
Well, I mean, if you read Cabrel, you'll just be so thrilled at the thought of getting involved and rolling your sleeves up on a new project with Bowie rather than revisiting them, salvaging something, wouldn't you?
Couldn't believe his luck. This is quite touching, very poignant here. So Cabrel's, this is him talking about the re-recording of Zeros. So this was like the sort of lead single from the box set, isn't it? He says, one of the things David and I used to do from Tin Machine right through to ours, we'd often double acoustic guitars together. So we'd sit facing each other with our guitars in front of the mics. And he said, I started playing Zeros on acoustic guitar and with my eyes closed while we were recording. And in my mind's eye, I saw David sitting right across from me, and I could see the way he'd move his shoulder when he was playing, and even the way he would cross his legs and bounce the cross leg a little bit while he was playing on his guitar. He'd look at you, but at the same time get this faraway look in his eye. So anyway, I did it. I got to the end of the track. I finished it, opened my eyes, and of course, he wasn't there. I knew at some point I was going to feel like I was about to cry. I knew it was coming. I was just so glad I was sitting alone in the studio when it finally happened.
Wow, what a moment.
Yeah.
What a moment. Okay, so he says, at one point, we all looked at each other and said, flip, we should take this band out on the road. If only the singer was alive. There were a number of things that were said. I could imagine David laughing at them. He was the one who said to me, death will never hurt an artist's career.
There you go.
The A to Z of David Bowie with Rob Hughes and Mark Riley.
N is for Tony Newman.
Richard Anthony Tony Newman, born 17th of March 1943 in Southampton, is an English rock drummer currently residing in Franklin, Tennessee. So his professional career began as a member of Sounds Incorporated, formed in early 1961 in Dartford, Kent, and were best known for their saxophone-led instrumental sound.
In August 1961, after Gene Vincent's band, the Blue Caps, had been denied permission to work in the UK, Sounds Incorporated were asked to back Vincent on his British tour and on several recording sessions in London. The success of these sessions led to opportunities to back other visiting American artists like Little Richard, Jerry Lee Lewis, Brenda Lee and Sam Cooke. Their only record with Parlophone, Mogambo, failed to sell at all.
OK, so the band then moved to Decca, where they released a trio of singles, the last of which was recorded with producer Joe Meek, which again fell on deaf ears. It was a chance encounter whilst performing in Hamburg that the band's fortunes changed. They met and befriended the Beatles, and in 1963 signed to Brian Epstein's management company, NEMS.
Ooh, handy. So the band's first two singles on new label Columbia, The Spartans and Spanish Harlem, made the UK singles chart in 1964. These were the only successes that Sounds Incorporated enjoyed in the UK. That same year, they became Cilla Black's backing band and released their first album called Sounds Incorporated. Their third Columbia single, a version of the William Tell Overture, was included. It turned out to be their biggest hit in Australia. Getting to number two, Mark.
Blimey. So the group toured the world as a Beatles opening act. Can you imagine?
Oh, hey.
How many times have these guys seen the Beatles? And it's just, I don't know. Somebody needs to catch up with Tony. He needs to write a book about the Beatles, does Tony Newman.
Oh, yes.
Including the August 1965 concert at New York City's Shea Stadium.
Oh, come on. That is history.
Yeah, Sound Incorporated continuing popularity ensured a stream of work, including backing duties at the televised Enemy Awards. In December 1964, Enemy reported that Sound Incorporated would appear at the Hammersmith Odeon at the Another Beatles Christmas show.
Oh, great. Unusual musical instruments were a feature. The battery-operated clavellin keyboard, as used by the Tornadoes, is heard on Keep Moving. It's also heard prominently on their previous disc before Meek, Sounds Like Locomotion. Al Holmes played the lead melody on the flute, by the way, throughout The Spartans.
OK. By 1967, the band's name had been truncated to Sounds, Inc. The Beatles invited Cameron, Holmes and West to be the saxophone section on their track Good Morning, Good Morning from the album Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. After this guest appearance, Sound Inc. left EMI and released a solitary single on the Polydor label. Titled How Do You Feel, it was the first single released to feature vocals.
The group began to disintegrate in the late 60s. Tony Newman left to work as a session musician. Didn't do badly, though. He was at various times, he was a member of Mayblitz, Three Man Army, T-Rex and Boxer.
So he's also performed with Jeff Beck, George Harrison, Robert Palmer, Eric Clapton, Donovan, Mick Ronson, Gene Vincent, Crystal Gayle, the Everly Brothers. He played on Donovan's Barabaja Gal, is that right?
Oh, I'm glad you did that one, mate.
As well as on Jeff Beck's Beckola, which is easier to say.
He was also one of the featured drummers on the soundtrack to the film version of The Who's Tommy. So we should really get to the Bowie connection here, shouldn't we?
Definitely. So for David Bowie, he performed on Diamond Dogs, the album, 1974, and Live with Bowie on the subsequent North American tour, including a recording at the Tower Philadelphia, released as David Live. Like that album, do you, Bob?
I've come round to it a bit.
Good.
Following the disintegration of the Spiders from Mars and with the covers album Pinups, which featured, of course, Mick Ronson, Trevor Boulder, though not Woody Woodmansey, but we decided to play as much of the music on his next album as possible.
He did. He called on the services of the ever-reliable and brilliant Herbie Flowers to play bass. So Trevor Boulder, as we remember on Diamond Dogs, he was asked to turn up, and he turned up at the studio. He hovered about a bit. Bowie didn't pay much attention to him. Trevor Boulder went out the door saying bye and got nothing back. My heart sank when I read all that, to be honest. But anyway, Blue Mink guitarist Alan Parker played on it, though Bowie did play a lot of the guitar on the record. Piano virtuoso Mike Garson was recalled, and two drummers, one being Ainsley Dunbar, who'd appeared on the 1984 show and Pinups, the other being Tony Newman. And it is funny, he's got two drummers here, but if you remember, I haven't mentioned it before, but not everybody gets to hear every episode of this podcast, sadly. My mate, and I call him the greatest living Englishman, but Vic Goddard.
Oh yes,
he recognised David Bowie's car, he got to know it, he was a fan, he could recognise Bowie's chauffeur, and he was outside Olympia Studios waiting for Bowie, and Vic went up to him and said, is Bowie in there? No, he's not, son. He isn't he? No, he's not, son. He is. What time's he coming out? 4 o'clock. So, and he waited for him. But the interesting thing was that he'd been recording. Bowie told Vic he'd been recording Rebel Rebel, but he'd been doing drums all day.
Oh, right. Wow.
So there you go. There's three drummers on this album.
Okay. So anyway, for whatever reason, it was Tony Newman, not Dunbar, who was invited onto the North American tour to promote Diamond Dogs. As a consequence, of course, as you mentioned, he plays on David Live. So we're going to look at this interview now with Tony Newman from Let It Rock, which is, and he has a great answer to a question from, another big Bowie fan. The question being, your career spans more than four decades. Don't you find it somewhat abusing or amusing that you're mostly remembered by your work with David Bowie?
His reply, it depends on the frame of reference you're coming from. Whenever I'm out with the Everly Brothers, people are interested in my career with Sound Incorporated. The first record I played on was with Gene Vincent in 1960. I'm going home. Sound Incorporated were a remarkable band to work with. I was sewn into the deep end right from the off. Little Richard, Sam Cooke, Jerry Lee Lewis, all that lot. Tours with the Beatles, always with top acts. So I didn't really have to do the grunge work. And all of the acts we were backing, I could copy what the drummers had played on the records. So it was first class all the way.
This as well from Modern Drummer website, and he talks about being a recovering alcoholic and also a drug addict, doesn't he? He started drinking age 13. It's remarkable.
Brutal.
He's introduced to speed by Gene Vincent during his spell with him, and this is where the interview went from there. So Modern Drummer asks him, when did you finally break free of your addictions?
So Tony said, I got sober in 1983, and that's when I took a one-way ticket to Nashville. Funny thing is, I've been fortunate with my accounts. In that sense, my life has been blessed. I mean, one day I'm working in the studio and I get a call from David Bowie. Can you come and do this? I left the band I was in, Three Man Army, to join Bowie. So Three Man Army featured the guys who then went on to form Baker Gurvitz.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And then the magazine asked a question, what can you tell us about working with him?
So Tony says, we were working on the Diamond Dogs album when David asked me, I'm doing a theatrical tour of America. Would you like to come on tour with us? We went to New York and we were there for a month rehearsing every day. I had no idea of David's repertoire. We're probably, you know, too busy to catch up. He was ever so nice. When I was in the studio with him, he never ever told me what to play. He'd give me scenarios of what he wanted me to imagine as I was playing drums. This is great. One of the scenarios for Sweet Thing was that he wanted me to imagine I was a teenage French drummer watching a guillotining for the first time.
Wow, okay. And so the magazine says, what? And Tony said, yeah, I'll never forget that. But for the tour, Tony Basil came in for the choreography, and there was a stage manager, someone we call Nick the Russian, who was actually called Nick Russian.
That's right.
He was actually a Broadway stage manager. When we came to the show, it was enormous. Bowie had these colossal sets. It was like a Broadway show, but on the road.
And he continued, we recorded the album, David Live, in Philadelphia, but I was doing so much blow that I didn't realise what was going on when I got on stage. I sat down and played A Basket Case. He said, that's what I was like. Apparently, we did another night, which I've no idea of. I thought I played dreadfully on both nights. I was doing a lot of cocaine and sharing it with a lot of other people. It was getting pretty bloody mad. He says here, I've never listened to David Live. I couldn't face listening to it. Then, apparently, they remixed that. My son called me from England and said, you ought to have a listen to this, Dad. You use a double kick and everything on it. I got a copy and read the liner notes, and I think David remarked that the drums were great both nights. And so the interviewer says to him, you thought you'd ruined it.
And Tony replies, absolutely, for fuck's sake, let's get through with this. And then my wife at the time, Margot, had gone nuts in England. So it's not a very sympathetic way of putting it, you have to say. But I got her to come to New York to see John Lennon's doctor. And he said she needed to go to the sanitarium. She brought two of the kids, and so they came on the road with me. The English bass player, Herbie Flowers, said he'd thoroughly had enough of touring and was leaving. For some reason, I left too. Earl Slick and the manager would call me, please come back, but I was so into my addiction that I didn't want to do it anymore. I'd burnt myself out. So he's on the road, he doesn't know what he's doing, he's got his kids on the road with him. I mean, you can't blame him really for taking a step back, can you? But what a way to drop out.
Absolutely. He talks here, carries on, he said, I was so sad when David died. I'd seen him a couple of times after I left. The show went on, obviously, and it worked out great. I always wanted to make amends to him for being so selfish. I was always professional and showed up and did my job prior to this, but all of a sudden the drugs had gotten to me and I went nuts. Horrible. I left my wife and kids and I was sitting in a flat in London drinking special brew and this Victorian laudanum called Dr. J. Collis Brown's cough mixture. I lost my drums in some deal around the time I was in the band Boxer, so I had nothing. I'd get this little bottle, shake it up, put it in a pint glass and drink it. Within about 10 minutes, the chloroform hit me and it would be euphoric, followed by 10 hours of heroin buzz. You know, you just cannot imagine, can you?
I mean, talk about grasping defeat from the jaws of victory. It's not a moral tale, is it? You know, I mean, people choose to do drugs. Different people react different ways, don't they?
Yeah.
But to end up without even a drum kit, and that continues here, doesn't it? So the magazine said, how do Mark Bolan and T-Rex figure in all of this? And he said, Herbie Flowers called me and said, Mark Bolan hasn't been on the road for a while and he really could do with a drummer. Will you come over? I said, I haven't got a drum kit. He said, I'll make sure they rent you one, not even buy them. Oh. I went over to the studio and made the drums sound pretty nice. I had a wonderful gig. I loved Bolan. He and I were great buddies. I think Mark Bolan was one of the greatest acts I've ever been on stage with. He had so much charisma. I'm really sorry he died. It was a great tragedy.
So despite all this kind of turmoil in his, you know, this sort of self-destruction in the 70s, he's playing with these greats.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the list, I mean, it's a cream of the crop, isn't it? And he is a fantastic drummer.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And Bowie was right, and Tony, your son, was right. Yeah, great drumming on David Live.
The A to Z of David Bowie was written and presented by Rob Hughes and Mark Riley. Recorded and edited by Howard Knock. With social media graphics by Jason Reed. If you'd like to review or rate this podcast, well, that would be much appreciated. In the next episode.
The 1980 Floor Show.
New York Dolls.
The next day.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.